severity?
You've measured a number of variables, grades 1, 3, 5, and so on. Are you going to expand the types of measurements, variables that you'll be measuring as the kids grow older? Autonomy, self-confidence, a variety of other...
When kids are 15, we are certainly measuring age-appropriate outcomes that are somewhat, but not exclusively, different than earlier, because there are issues in adolescence that weren't there earlier.
Sure.
But because it's a study of 1,364 children spread across 10 different sites, even with $150 million, it only goes so far. They have to be reliably measurable in standard scientific terms. So autonomy in some sense, yes. And I know autonomy, yes, we are getting at. So I think there are. I mean, we've measured a lot more than what I've shared with you, quite frankly. And we will be.
Good work.
Thank you. But again, it's not just my work. It's an army of people's work.
How long are you going to track these kids for?
Well, we have money now to track these kids. And as we speak, they're being tracked at age 15. The funding agency has said, we're done. We're not going to track these kids anymore with our money. So we now have some plans, it looks like. There are three different foundations that look like they're prepared to pony up some money to enable us to see these kids around the time they finish high school, or just when they might be starting college, university, to see about that transition to adulthood and how it's going. That's not even a promissory note at this point, because the kids are only 15. That's a hope and an aspiration. I think I give it a three-quarter chance of being realized.
I love the way you present this amazing material and the discussion about values and balancing that with the evidence and the focus on the quality of childhood itself and not just on outcomes. I like that a lot and identify with that. I was just curious, if children did end up with clinical problems, how did the study deal with them in terms of reporting? And then what are your reflections on increased diagnosis of ADHD and that kind of thing?
In terms of clinical problems, we wanted to look at clinical problems, but they're so little in our sample that there's no statistical power to do so. We were always there to provide referral if we thought there was concern. And it wasn't that much, because we didn't have extreme problems, and where there were problems, we probably had differential dropouts too. One of the things that we haven't done in this study, and I wonder what the implications of it are, is we never measured over the kids' first 4.5 years of life whether they were being medicated. And I have this hunch that these effects on aggression and disobedience would be higher and bigger if we could take into account medication. Because who in their first 4.5 years of life are getting medicated? Not kids who are simply a challenge to their parents, because parents have a way of coping. It's when you want to go back to work, or you're back to work and your kid's in child care and again you're getting thrown out of child care because they can't handle them, then the option is medication. And if that's the case, and we know this medication can be effective, then we could be underestimating an effect here. And I scratch my head about it all the time, and when I speculate in certain audiences, they just think, oh, that's just right-wing Jay who's against daycare and a misogynist on top, you know, wondering about these things and the only way he wonders about these things. But nevertheless, and in fact, is there any evidence, in fact, and this could be studied, I guess, that medication is more likely to be prescribed to kids in child care settings than not kids in child care settings? And if that's the case, again, would these symptoms be higher than they're appearing, and would these effects be larger than they're appearing? Now, in terms of treating HD, you know, I'm not a clinical psychologist. I'm not in position to wonder about, to even have any real strong opinion on it. I tend not to be knee-jerk against anything, be it medication or therapy or just waiting for it to disappear, because all those things work some of the time. One of the things that astonishes me, as someone who doesn't study clinical issues, is when I came out of graduate school in 1978, Ritalin was an issue. 30 years later, Ritalin's still an issue. It's just, you know, a treatment that seems to be both effective and ineffective and leave, you know, room for everybody to be for and against it. Yeah.
Just a few points of clarification. First, when you showed figures that had to do with the quality of daycare, was that comparing the high-quality daycare with low-quality daycare or high-quality daycare with
excellent question.
Maternal care.
With no care. No, it's just more and less quality. So to get a quality measurement, you had to be in some kind of child care arrangement and have quality measured. So when kids were 6 months, 15 months, even 24 months of age, you could imagine, for example, that everybody at this table and this table and this table were left out of the analysis because they were in exclusively mother care and we didn't have quality of care measurement. Okay? By the time the kids were 4.5 years of age at 54 months, like 98% of the kids were in some kind of, quote, child care arrangement. Could have been a nursery, could have been a preschool, could be part-time. So then we had quality measurements.
Okay, I guess that answers it. The second question is going to be, do you have figures that compare quality daycare with maternal care?
We do. And it's an interesting problem. In fact, it points out the biases of my blind spot and the biases of my collaborators. We once reported evidence looking at the kids' cognitive functioning in high-quality child care and mother-only care and mother care. And actually, that's how it came out. Kids did cognitively better in high-quality child care than they did on mother care. But when on reflection, two things struck me. One is, why don't we compare high-quality care to any kind of mother care? Why don't we compare it to high-quality mother care? But we didn't. And nobody ever has spotted that logical problem in our analysis. More disconcerting was the fact that when we reported those problem behavior findings in 2001 at our conference, there was hysteria among my colleagues. There were stories all over the news. There were things being said about me that were so damning. I finally wrote a letter to my colleagues and said, I consulted an attorney, which I hadn't done, and if this doesn't stop, I'm going to sort of take you to court for slander. And one of the criticisms of me was, you know, Jay, you talk about these problems, this time in child care and problem behavior, and you're making mothers feel guilty. And I always say, I say two things. Well, I said one thing in response to that I used to say. I said, you know, I grew up in a Jewish family. You know, who outlawed guilt as an emotion? You know, why did nature design a psychology with guilt? You know, and you think the fact that somebody feels guilty is a bona fide reason not to say something. My goodness, I mean, it's so idiotic. It's amazing that somebody could. But here's the interesting thing. So here you have this sensitivity to the guilt of working mothers, if you would, who use child care. But we made that comparison between high-quality child care and stay-at-home mothers. Nobody gave a bloody damn about how stay-at-home mothers felt. It never occurred to them. And I wasn't sharp enough, given all the other fires I was fighting, to say, wait a minute, how dare you do this? And again, it's just a reflection of how uneven this, you know, scientific playing field is. That you worry about making working mothers feel guilty, but you don't give a damn about potentially casting aspersions on stay-at-home mothers. You call it a small effect size when it's bad news about time and care, but you never qualify it as a small effect size when you're talking about the good news around the value of quality care. That's just a story I'm stimulated to tell.
Jay, if I understand correctly, you sent your teams into these homes to observe the parent-child interaction.
Among other things. That was one of the things they did. Yeah.
For example, you would witness such cases as you described a little earlier of the so-called negligent mother misfeeding the child, or perhaps parents slapping around kids and this kind of thing. And so that I'm going to ask a stupid question, because I'm not familiar with this kind of research, but I'm interested in your answer, and that is that. What kind of parents, knowing that there are teams of interviewers in their homes, would behave that way in front of observers? If I were in that situation, I'd be on my best behavior. And I think most people would too. Which leads to the question then, the ones who are really parents who are showing very poor parenting skills, they must be real bad parents because they're not even conscious. What's your answer to that question?
It's actually a very good question. It goes back to the very first study I did, which when so the question becomes, when you go in and you observe people, we observe people in even tighter conditions than that, where we brought them into the laboratory, gave them toys to play with the child, and we videotaped them, and they knew they were being videotaped. Okay, but sensitivity is an interesting construct. We didn't see, when we went into the homes, we did monitor, was a kid, did a parent, you know, physically slap or yell at a kid or something like that, and that was rare. But you know, most of us aren't good actors, actually. And there are things you can't really fake very well. And I'll tell you a story about going into a home with a mother, and it could have been a father, behaving just like you said. And this mother sat down. You know, I was there, and I always said, I'm interested in the experiences your children had. I didn't say, I'm interested in observing your mothering because of just this consideration. Not that this mother was necessarily stupid. So what did she do? She pulled out with a toy chest, and she sat the, this was a 15-month-old in my doctoral dissertation, she sat the kid down, and she pulled out one toy, see this, one toy, see this. You know, she got a really high stimulation score level, but she couldn't have been more insensitive. She never followed the kid's lead. So sensitivity is a kind of thing where, you know, at some point it's hard to fake, and I suspect we end up with a narrower range than actually is out there in life, but we still pick up variation that seems to go along with some of these experiences. So while there is a fake element and, you know, you're putting on a show and that kind of thing, there's a degree to which you just can't lie about it. You know, when your kid turns his head away, you have the impulse to reach out and turn his head back, versus another mother or father, you'd never think to do that kind of thing.
Hi, I'm just wondering about your first implication for policy, extend paid parental leave. In Canada, if you're in an employer-employee relationship, you get up to a year of employment insurance. If you're self-employed, you get nothing.
Okay.
So we do have a year, which is much more generous than the U.S.
Yeah.
But what did you find from your study? Like, if you were going to make a recommendation of extending EI more?
What we would have loved to do is compare kids who started child care in their first year and went and stopped in their second year with kids who didn't go in their first year and started in their second year, with kids who didn't go in their first 2 years and started in their third year, with kids, because then you could really tease apart the timing issues. The problem is, because this is a non-experimental study, because you're not going to participate in a study where I say you're going to stay home for a year and then put your kid in lousy care, and you're going to stay home for a year and then put your kid in good care, and you're going to go to work for a year and then you're going to put your kid in lousy care, and you're going to go to work for a year, and you know, I mean, you can't do that, thankfully. So it's hard to know for sure how much of the effect is really a first-year effect or thereafter, because they're confounded. The people who start child care for 30 hours or more a week in the first year of life are the ones most likely to be having that much child care in the second, third, fourth year of life. So we have this confounding. But it looks to me that it's early, extensive, and continuous care, especially the more likely that care is in centers. Because to have that high score in center care, it meant you had more measurement occasions of center care. Well, most people didn't start center care at 6 months and 15 months and then switch to family daycare or nanny care. If anything, it's the other way around. So lots of occasions of center-based care is care that starts off early in centers and continues. And that turns out to be the fastest growing, it's not the norm, but it's the fastest growing amount of child care, because families want centers. Why? Because they don't mess up schedules. You know, if your family daycare provider decides she gets sick, you're up the proverbial creek. If your nanny quits, you're up the creek. Your child care center is unlikely to close down, even though the caregivers come and go. And that looks to you, all too often to consumers, as if that's stable and good. When in fact, why is that good? Just because, you know, the house is the same, but the players keep moving around? Kind of thing. So I emphasize paid parental leave because there's certainly suggestive evidence that, well, first of all, because if you had paid parental leave, all of a sudden kids would be spending less time in care. That first year is off the shelf. So now you're only talking about, you know, 3.5 years as opposed to 4.5 years in the case of a lot of kids, kind of thing. Yeah.
When you talk about quality, I don't know how you would answer the question, but how many children were actually involved in high quality care as opposed to low quality care?
Quality was measured irrespective of amount of kids in care, because let's imagine this is a child care center, okay? And let's imagine I'm the caregiver. And let's imagine you're the kid in my study. I'm really nice to him, and I'm really nice to him, and I'm really lousy to him, and I'm really mean to him, and I ignore her completely. That didn't matter. What mattered was what I would call the psychological nutrients you got from me. How attentive, responsive, stimulating, and affectionate was I to you? Not to the class in general, not to these seven sampled people on average as representative of the class, but to you. We went in and we observed what life looked like through your eyes in terms of being in that setting. Now, while it's harder to be sensitive if the group's too big, rest assured there are caregivers who can be skilled and sensitive with 12 kids, and caregivers who with one aren't very good at all. So sensitivity was really a measure of what your psychological experience in that setting was while you were there. And certainly if a group gets too big, then it's harder to be sensitive. But I would say certainly as important as the size of the group is simply the attributes of the caregiver.
My question is a little different.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Out of 100 kids or 1,000 that actually went to child care and centers, how many had good quality and how many had bad quality? Like that?
I skipped over a slide having to do with that for time considerations. This isn't quite exactly that answer to that question, but it's close enough, I think. Okay. Here we have the quality of care. We rated quality of care in terms of observed positive caregiving, attentive, responsive, stimulating, was not at all characteristic of the setting with the child in the setting. Somewhat uncharacteristic, somewhat characteristic, highly characteristic. Okay. Now, this is a glasses half full, glasses half empty, depending on how you want to spin it. And it's been spun both ways. Because if you look at it, if you take your purple and your turquoise, we've got about 48% of the kids, half the kids, at 6 months or 15 months of age, who was in any kind of care, were not getting care that would qualify as good, because it was somewhat uncharacteristic, positive caregiving, okay? By 24 months of age, that's 58%. And by 36 months of age, that's 61%. So, in other words, at least half of the kids are getting, at best, fair quality care. And some of them are getting poor quality care. Now, this is an interesting question because there's been a big debate about what the average quality of care is in the United States. And the child care advocacy people have, on the one hand, wanting to get more money and resources pumped into it, claim that the quality of child care is poor. Some of my colleagues said, look at these data. These data don't substantiate that claim, because the only thing that qualifies as poor is not at all characteristic. 6%, 8%, and 4%. Now, clearly, we don't have a nationally representative sample here. In fact, this is clearly an understatement of poor quality care, because there were settings that wouldn't let us in. Okay? You know, we enrolled you and your family and your child. Your child then was cared for by him. We got your permission to contact him about letting us see how he cared for the kid. Most people let us in. Those people who didn't let us in, be it a center or a private person, we presume, and I think there's a reasonable basis for presuming this, we're getting poor quality care. So this is as close to an answer as I can give you. And it's suggesting that at least 50% of the care out there doesn't qualify as good. I think we've one more.
First of all, the price of admission was paid when you showed that slide on the contagion theory of, you know, because that's a profound thing to think about in the sense of kind of the additive effects of these low effect sizes and how that still contributes to what we consider some sort of a meeting of the means as far as those. And you're the only one that could get away with showing effect sizes that low. I'd never be able to show that at a conference. I wouldn't even be accepted to do that. But obviously you can do that. Question about, and it's related to effect sizes, you flip past these slides pretty quickly as well, on the much larger effect sizes of sensitive parenting and things like that. Do you have a comment to make about the role that, again, positive, that sensitive parenting can have? And did you guys measure changes in sensitivity as far as parenting goes over this same amount of time?
We did. First of all, let me say this. What we don't know in these parenting effects, I was about to say this earlier, but I just skipped over it, is how much of this is genetic and how much of it is really environmentally mediated. That is, if you're my mother, let's say, we can have genes that lead you to be sensitive, and I can inherit those genes, and they lead me to be, let's say, socially skilled. Okay? Without understanding those genes, your sensitivity predicts my social skills. It looks like a sensitivity effect on my social skills. It may not be. It may be a third variable problem, shared genes. I'm sure some of this is that. I doubt all of it's that, but sure, some of it's that. Now, we did measure sensitivity over time. Okay? And sensitivity is reasonably stable over time. That is, well, there are certainly mothers, let's say, who are insensitive with their infants, but skilled with their six-year-olds. On average, that's not the case. Sensitivity is a surprisingly, well, I don't think surprising at all, is a reasonably stable construct. I think it's reasonably stable because what does it take to be, because it's about the person. And what does it take to be sensitive? Which, again, is not to say that some people don't go up and down, but on average, and in fact, the sensitivity construct isn't measured. The issue really isn't whether the mean goes up and down, because if you're, you know, let's take that feeding example I gave earlier. If your kid's four and you're still shoveling food into his mouth, and he's perfectly capable of picking up that spoon and feeding himself, it doesn't matter how sensitive you are, you're insensitive. So the same behavior at a different age reflects differently on sensitivity and insensitivity. So different behaviors, sensitivity is manifested in different ways at different ages.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just something on sensitivity. I have to share with people, I think we need more studies, as you say, looking at when kids are in and then taken out and the parent is home or not home, whatever. You have to look at the conditions that allow a mother or a father to be more or less sensitive.
Sure.
When you have a spouse coming home and doing a 40-hour work week and going home and doing the gender balance of work, division of labor, etc., you have a lot of mothers who are going home very tired. So I think if you're going to look at the sensitivity side, then you have to address in your policy perspective, what kind of flexibility do you need on the workforce to develop and to have a healthy community, healthy family, because you have parents who will be sensitive because their time allows them to have...
I couldn't agree more. In fact, these parenting effects actually are maybe underestimates for this reason. We've controlled for maternal depression. We've controlled for maternal education. We've even controlled in place for maternal work stress. Those have effects on sensitivity. If you took those out, these effects of sensitivity would probably go up because they're overlapping effects. Now, in terms of the, you know, you raised an issue that when we found that more time in any type of care led to more problem behaviors, and this isn't the center issue, this is the overall dosage of care, more time in any type of care was related to more problem behavior at 4.5 years of age, in kindergarten and in first grade, even though it was gone in third grade. Okay, let's stick to the earlier age. We had two ideas about where this effect came from. One idea was that it's the legacy, as I hypothesized 20 years ago, of an insecure attachment. That is, the lots of time in care forces insecurity, and the insecurity itself forces later aggression and disobedience. Well, if that's the case, then what you should be able to do is link up lots of time in care with later aggression, which we did, but that effect should disappear when you statistically control for the presumed mediator, attachment security. It's like domino A knocks over domino B, knocks over domino C. So if you take out domino B, knocking over domino A will knock over domino C. That didn't happen. That is, it didn't look like the effect of time in care was mediated or flowed through attachment security. You said, okay, we have something else we'll look at. Let's look at the mother-infant interaction, the mother-child interaction, the sensitivity measurement. Because one of my thoughts was, you know, it's not so much child care that's causing this aggression and disobedience. It's more like what you're saying is, the kid's off at work all day, he's at child care. I'm off at work all day, I'm at work. I come home, I'm stressed out, I'm not particularly sensitive. That's what's fostering the aggression and disobedience. So we did the same A to B to C analysis. Doesn't work. That doesn't seem to be explaining what's going on. It's not quality care either. So actually, at least with 4.5 years of age, we have what we've labeled, or I've labeled, the developmental mystery. How does this affect occasion? What's driving it? In fact, even when you get to the issue of center care, and aggression at later ages, we don't have really much sense of how that comes about. I mean, people say, well, do you think it's this or do you think it's that? And I say, you know what? It's open season on hypotheses. We wanted to do more than simply say that this child care characteristic predicted this outcome. We wanted to be in position to explain how it does it, what the process is. Well, in this case, we've got the prediction and the outcome, but our attempts to illuminate the process have come up empty-handed. And I'm beginning to think that one of the big mistakes we made was that we saw the world from two adult-centric view. And so we focused on quality of care instead of what's the world appears like. I could be really sensitive to this kid, really attentive and responsive. But if all the other kids in this group, you know, are mean and nasty, then maybe they're having a much more bigger impact on his eventual aggression and disobedience than what I'm doing. And thus, maybe we didn't pay enough attention to studying what the other kids were doing to each other and to him, kind of thing. But your questions, your point's very well taken, which is what's going on at the end of the day. There's a part of me that thinks we not only miss the peer side of things, we miss the father side of things at the end of the day. Because I had done a small study, which I basically don't talk about anymore, which actually found evidence that the effect of time and care on problem behavior was mediated by father-infant interaction, father-child interaction, as well as mother-child interaction at the end of the day. We didn't go into the homes at the end of the workday in this big study, like I've done in other studies, and observe what goes on there. And I suspect I reason to believe that there's tension in that dynamic there, between what father's doing, what mother's doing, how exhausted they are, how they're getting along, and that there's a contributing process to what all this time away from the kid is. Because my thinking goes something like this, is that if you spend a lot of time away from your child, if you're a really skilled, capable parent, you can overcome that. But if you're just an average parent, or even an above average parent, where do you gain the knowledge of this particular kid to be sensitive to him? To know that he always turns his head away when his mouth is full. You have to wait for him to turn it back. Okay? And so now you lack that subtlety of knowledge because you just don't have as much time on task. You haven't had as much time to learn what's going on in this particular child. Now you come home at the end of the day, especially during the second and third year of life, the so-called terrible twos, he starts throwing developmental curveballs at you. If you've got a rich foundation in him or her, you cope with those in a different way than if he is, and I'm going to use this, you know, being hyperbolic here, if he's somewhat of a stranger. So there may be something about all that time away that makes you less knowledgeable, less skilled, perhaps especially for father and mother co-parenting and working together, that contributes to this later aggression and disobedience. So the effect of child care then is flowing through the family and then the child. But that's all speculation. But I think the point's well taken about what's going on here at the end of the day in these families.